Welcome to the latest episode of our Canada's Medical Law Matters podcast series. I'm Rob Tobin, a lawyer specialising in medical law here at Canada's, where we act on behalf of the NHS and public sector organisations and private healthcare providers, all on aspects of healthcare and medical law. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by two guests, Dr. Ty Glover, consultant psychiatrist, and Professor Richard Holton, Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Cambridge. I'll let Ty and Richard introduce themselves properly in a moment. Today we'll be discussing mental capacity to make decisions about medical treatment, both from a practical perspective, how it's assessed and measured, and from a philosophical perspective, delving into the meanings of choice and autonomy. You can subscribe to this podcast through your usual podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, or through our website, and do engage in the discussion and provide any feedback around this episode and other episodes and any discussions we've had. So Ty and then Richard, please, can you perhaps briefly introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Ty Glover. I'm a consultant psychiatrist in eating disorders and have been in the eating disorder field for over 20 years now. Over the last 12 or 13 years, I've developed some expertise as an independent medico-legal expert giving evidence in the court of protection with probably about half of the cases relating to eating disorders and half of the cases relating to other general psychiatric conditions.
Thank you. And Richard?
Hello, I'm Richard Holton. I'm a philosopher, University of Cambridge, as Rob says, although not specifically in moral philosophy. I do moral philosophy, but I also do a lot of philosophy of mind. I work with psychologists. I've done quite a lot of stuff on addiction and other issues that are to do with the difficult area between what we have control over, what we don't really have.
Thank you. And that's the perfect way to delve, I think, into the Mental Capacity Act and mental capacity in general, because it's a lot of it is around control. So perhaps I can start just to introduce to listeners, some of whom, or many of whom will probably know all of this, but some of whom may not, just about what the Mental Capacity Act says around mental capacity. So again, we're talking about the mental capacity to make medical treatment decisions here on this episode. And the Mental Capacity Act 2005 makes clear that it's assumed that every adult has the mental capacity to make decisions about their medical treatment. And it's also around property and affairs, but again, we'll just talk about medical treatment here. And that assumption is there unless it's established otherwise. And it's sometimes tested because clinicians treating that person, or perhaps it might be someone else, it might be people who know them, suspect that they may not have capacity at that particular moment. And it might be a temporary or a more long-term situation, but for the purposes of the assessment, it's always very specific, so decision-specific. Section 3 of the Mental Capacity Act says that the person is unable to make a particular decision for themselves if they are unable to understand the information relevant to the decision, unable to retain that information, unable to use or weigh that information as part of the process of decision making, and unable to communicate their decision by talking, or could be using sign language or any other means of communication. And Section 2, and this is perhaps the crux of our discussion today, says that a person lacks capacity to make a specific decision if at the material time, the reason they cannot make that decision is because of an impairment of or a disturbance in the functioning of their mind or brain. And that might be temporary or permanent. And it need not be a psychiatrist or a psychologist to make that determination about persons mental capacity, but it often is, and it's often those specialists who are turned to, particularly where there are tricky situations. Perhaps a person might have an underlying mental disorder, or perhaps coincidentally, they may have another personality disorder or factor, which is perhaps making their presentation a lot more complex than it might be. So Ty, if you're that psychiatrist who's being called to assess someone, perhaps as part of the court of protection case, how do you go about conducting that assessment?
Thanks, Rob. Well, there's often a long history around these patients, and they've often become terribly complicated. And so there's a lot of noise. I mean, one of the things on a practical level I often do is I don't read much of the history before I go and assess a patient. I obviously have to orientate yourself to the case, but other than that, I tend to listen to the story from the patient, from P first, which it originally started because of disorganization on my part. Early in my medical legal career, I wouldn't have time to read the notes, and then I'd end up going to see the patient first. But actually, I think it gives you a very objective view. So it's very difficult not to form opinions if you start reading notes about somebody. So I try not to do that. Go and see them. And the other thing I focus on is, which again often gets lost, is what exactly is the medical decision? So that can sometimes, you know, they're not accepting treatment. Well, they're accepting some treatment. What bits of treatment are they actually not accepting? So obviously in the case of anorexia, it's nutrition. And then you speak to them in detail about the relevant decision. So why are you not accepting nasogastric feeding? And in a lot of cases, patients will straightforwardly tell you that they are overweight, they're going to gain weight, they can't bear putting on any more weight, they need to lose more weight in a very classical way. You then take a history to understand what that individual was like, particularly focusing on childhood, major relationships, to try and get a sense of what the individual was like as they grew up. Most often, of course, you're dealing with relatively young adults, usually young women. And then you should then be seeing fairly starkly a medical decision about which the decision-making process is distorted by a very clear process, which is recognized to us psychiatrists, and has materially affected the nature of that person, looking back into childhood. And many of them, although there will be some disordered eating, there will be 15, 18 years of normal diet and normal behavior, which has then been changed. And I think that then means you can confidently explain to the judge in relation to the material decision, there is a flaw in P's thinking, often in terms of understanding, because they think they're overweight or they think food will make them fat, but certainly in the terms of their ability to weigh in the balance, because their fear of gaining weight is so extreme, it completely distorts their pattern of thinking. And therefore, on that particular decision, they lack capacity to make the decision about nutrition. That's how I would go about it, in very, you know, keeping to the big topics that matter in that assessment.
Thank you, Ty. We're focusing here on that part of the Mental Capacity Act which requires a cause or reason for the inability to use or weigh, retain, communicate, etc., i.e. that because of that disturbance or a disturbance in the mind or brain, someone is unable to make a particular decision. I'd like to delve more into that idea, perhaps looking into a distinction between a disturbance which alters or controls one's ability to make a decision and a choice made, consciously or otherwise, out of free will. We often hear phrases such as, it's the anorexia talking, it's not me. I'm interested to know what that means. So Richard, as a non-medic, as am I, what are your thoughts on this and of control and autonomy?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of things here, obviously, and so it's quite difficult, I think, to tease apart the various ways in which you might think that the mind or brain has gone wrong. Yeah, I mean, so I take it there are some cases where you, with things like phobias, say, where the person knows they have some particular problem, they really wish they didn't have the problem, and they're asking for help to overcome it. And I think that, you know, that's not problematic, right? Then we think, well, given the help, we can get past a behavior which is, you know, largely out of control. Whereas I take it in most of these cases with eating disorders, it's a very different situation to that. It's not as though the person just straightforwardly thinks they're doing something that they don't want to be doing. It's that they think, well, you know, in some sense, this is the right thing for me to be doing, and everybody else around me is telling me it's the wrong thing to be doing. So obviously, that one thing you could say is, well, you know, we're just going to look to their welfare. We're not really interested in their autonomy or anything like that. They're going to get very sick. They're at risk of dying if they don't eat properly. So we're just going to make sure we feed them. I mean, I think that would be just taking over the autonomy. Whereas I take it with these cases, the sort of thing we're looking at where we think there's a lack of capacity, we think that it's not just that we want to see in terms of their welfare, that in some sense we think that the patient is in a position where they can't really act rationally or act in a way which is in control. And I see two possible ways of understanding that. And one is a sort of to do with consistency. It's to do with whether or not they can bring the various things they believe into some kind of balance. So, you know, they might not want to eat, but they might want to eat. And you think, okay, so there's something gone wrong sort of in the internal stuff. The other way I can see it going wrong is if you think that there's some failure of perception in some way. So, and that could be of all sorts of different things. I mean, it might be a failure of the facts. So the straightforward physical facts about, you know, how thin you are, about how much food you need, about what eating this, what effects that will have, could be something like that. Or it could be something more like a sort of misperception of value, you know, that the value of thinness is worth more than all the other kinds of values. Now, I think once we say that, I think that, you know, that is a plausible thing to say here. But I think now we're in a very difficult area, because in some sense, you've got to think that you've got sufficient confidence to just judge that that perception of value is mistaken. And that requires, you know, a lot of assumptions about the nature of values and whether or not people can just simply get them wrong, the impact of society in distorting that, all the other kinds of things that you might think are relevant.
Yeah, and I suppose, and I'll ask you both this, I mean, because Richard, you mentioned rational behavior just in what you were just saying, and, you know, one of the tenets of the Mental Capacity Act and the law generally is that it's okay to make an unwise decision. That doesn't mean you lack capacity. Someone may have had anorexia or been diagnosed with anorexia for 20, 30, 50 years. You know, there might be a point, arguably, where one's brain or mind isn't disturbed. That is their natural position. To use a different example, someone might have some kind of compulsive personality where perhaps they enjoy the thrill of taking risks, living on the edge, taking drugs, perhaps drinking to excess. And those choices are not controlled or heavily influenced by a disturbance, but they're part of that person. And the consequence of that in drinking, say, is that they get drunk. And being drunk can well be an example of someone who lacks capacity if they're so drunk that they're not able to make those decisions. But before they get to that point, that person is arguably making irrational decisions. They're not safe decisions, but they're nonetheless decisions that would ordinarily be in society be regarded as decisions that they can make as autonomous individuals. What's the difference between that person, say, making those decisions and someone who has anorexia or a different condition and has had it their whole life?
Yes, it's difficult to disentangle someone who's had lifelong adult patterns of behavior in some respects from, say, someone who's had anorexia throughout all their adult life, other than the fact that anorexia is very recognizable. It has clear symptoms and signs, and it always presents in pretty much always presents in the same way and is recognizable as an illness. And the person will recognize themselves often that their thinking is distorted. And if they should recover, they are almost always accept that at the material time they lacked capacity. One of the points you raised earlier, Richard, was about whether there's a misperception. And very often there is a factual misperception. There is, just as an example, I remember one young woman, I mean, it's 10 years ago now, but she came through the door to the ward round. And as she sat down, she said, "Phew." And I said, "What do you mean, phew?" She said, "I wasn't sure I'd fit through the door." And she was 5.5 stone and the door was a standard door. So she was out by a factor of about 8, I would think. So, she wasn't making it up. It wasn't something said for effect. So with a lot of them, there is a genuine misperception and a failure to accept some of the very severe physical risks that they can be running. So, and the other thing about the point I was making was, I'm talking about capacity. not necessarily what happens beyond capacity. I know that, Richard, you have some, you know, view on that, but in a legal sense, that nothing's happened here in this determination other than I think they have or haven't got capacity. So returning to your chronic anorexic, Rob, I think that's very, very difficult. My own view, somebody who's had anorexia for 34 years out of a 50-year life, I still think their thinking is flawed in a way that it wouldn't be if they didn't have anorexia, which I recognize as an illness.
So Richard, what's your view on that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, this idea of it sort of being part of the person. I mean, it seems to me that being part of the person isn't enough to show that there isn't a failure of capacity here. I mean, you know, you could think that someone who was psychotic, you know, that was an ongoing issue for them, and they recognized that, and you know, they very much thought of themselves as someone who was suffering from that, very much part of their personality, and yet still think, yeah, you know, this is a distortion, right? There's no way we can think it's anything other than that. I think with eating disorders, it can be more complicated, though, and that's because when you say it's part of the person, it's not just that it's been chronic. It may be that it really has affected the value scheme that the person has. So, you know, pushing further on Ty's thoughts, so some of the patients here are going to be in a position where they do have really distorted views about their own size and the likely effect of eating and so on. I suppose we take a case where the person doesn't make those mistakes, right? They're perfectly clear-eyed about the risks. They're perfectly clear-eyed about, you know, what their actual size is. They just have got a value scheme where they value that more than anything else. Now, so what do we say then, right? Because I think that's a sense in which it's kind of got into the personality. And I actually think there are some similar cases with addiction, the stuff you were talking about earlier. I mean, there's, you know, we're often cautious to use words like addict in the thought that that's in some way stigmatizing. But a lot of people who are struggling with addiction actually very much see themselves as that. That is very much part of their conception of how their life goes. And there is, for some of those people, something they really value in that. So I think if at that point we say, look, there's still a failure of capacity here, it's not just that we think it's bad for your welfare, but we genuinely think there's a capacity failure, you've got in some sense to think that evaluation like that is not a legitimate one, that somehow those values are misperceiving the true nature of what is valuable. And I don't think that's out of the question. And I think there are reasons for thinking that. You may well think that the social pressures are such that people can't get their value systems straight. But it's a, you know, that's a major thing to have to think, I think. Really got to take a very strong line about the ways in which you're not prepared to think the values like that are legitimate values.
Yeah, and I suppose things like religion or belief systems might come in here. And when someone, you know, if a value is particularly tenacious, say, and it's been their whole life or a long time, does it become then more legitimate? Perhaps Ty, again, let's move away temporarily at least from the eating disorder world. If someone, and bear in mind, we're not, you mentioned illness, but of course, in the Mental Capacity Act, you don't necessarily have to have a recognized diagnosable mental disorder to fall into the category of lacking capacity. But if someone, perhaps they express a wish that they do want to live, but they also, in the next sentence, express a refusal to accept certain treatment that would save their life, perhaps because of their values. Ty, as an independent expert coming in, being asked to give an opinion on a person's capacity to make this profound medical decision, how much weight do you give to each of those views in determining whether or not they've got capacity?
If you've got values and you've held those beliefs for a long time, then there is something about those recognized beliefs that you, of course, respect. I mean, the Jehovah's Witness and blood transfusion is one that's been frequently accepted as a belief. And I completely take Richard's point that, you know, someone's developed a set of values, their values have changed, and it isn't our job to come in at 50 and and allocate our values to those matters. One has to respect an individual's values. And of course, I'm very mindful in these situations that your job as the independent expert and the psychiatrist isn't to make the decision. It's to advise the court of my thoughts on that decision. So I wouldn't be able to discuss from a philosophical point of view the law the way Richard can, but I could take my independent expert hat off and say, yeah, of course, I completely see what you're saying. But my role in the court is to say to the judge, this is what I've seen in these illnesses. These are the patterns of thinking I have seen. And I, you know, my opinion is that this is distorted. This person lacks capacity on these grounds. And this is the evidence I'm drawing from the history. And then I think it's very much not my decision. You just have to try and get to know them. You have to treat the person holistically and understand. You have to meet their family. You have to spend quite a lot of time with them. You have to try to get a real sense of that individual and how they've ended up at that point. Yeah. Where do those views come from?
Yeah. Thank you. Richard, when looking at mental capacity from the prism of autonomy and choice, do you see it as a conflict for a person to articulate a wish to live, but at the same time refusing perhaps the only treatment that will keep them alive?
So, I mean, clearly there are some cases where people say just that sort of thing, right? I mean, you know, if you have a terminal illness, you might say you don't want to die, you wish you didn't have the illness, but you don't want the treatment because you think the treatment is, quite possibly not going to work and is too invasive, and you would rather, you know, live your last days without those kind of interventions. So I think, you know, we can't immediately conclude from someone saying, look, I want to live and I don't want to do this, that something's gone wrong. So I think you've got to look to the specifics of it. And this is very much picking up what Ty says about the need to talk a lot with someone to see what the grounds are for doing that. So I think once you've got to the point where there's clearly just a sort of conflict in what they say, that is, there's a real sense in which they, in these cases, do want to eat and don't want to, then I think there are some grounds for thinking that there's a lack of capacity there. And that's the sort of internal case that I was talking about earlier, where the internal thinking has gone wrong in some way. So there, yes, I think there are grounds then for thinking there's a breakdown in capacity. What's more difficult, I think, is if they end up looking much more like the person who, you know, refuses treatment when terminally ill because they think the treatment isn't worth it, even though they wish they weren't terminally ill.
So the context is very relevant. I mean, and Ty, presumably would you agree with that you need to understand why they've come to the decision they have, or why they're articulating what they're articulating, so that you can understand them better?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the 35-year history in somebody who's 50 years old, it would be ridiculously presumptuous to suggest you could have any sense of understanding what their life had been with anorexia. And they understand their condition very well. They, you know, the reasons for their behavior are now very entrenched. And what one tries to do is really in those situations is, well, you work alongside somebody really rather than in opposition to them. You really try to maximize those aspects of their life that they're bothered about, which is rarely the dietary intake, but you have to accept that. And you almost treat them as pretty much as a capacitous patient. You're trying to persuade them of the need for sort of, to them, noxious treatment, just like you'd, you know, need to be persuaded to have your broken arm manipulated, you know, as we all would, because we know it's going to be unpleasant. So they can be persuaded and engaged to the maximum that they can tolerate it, which is really treating them as a capacitous, sort of resistant individual. And that's much, much more common, I think, in approach in those patients who've had the condition for a very long time.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say then that the unwise decision which, as we said earlier, is perfectly legitimate in the law, becomes an incapacitous decision when it is influenced or overly influenced by a disturbance in the mind or brain.
That's the way the law would have it, yes. That's how I would interpret it as an expert. In real life with these patients, what you do is you sort of tread a line between, you've got a capacity of your own so you can make those decisions, as in, I'm going to go on 3 nights leave, even though I'll probably lose weight, but I want to see my sister, versus, I don't think you've got capacity, but it's in your best interest anyway to go on those 3 nights leave and see your sister, because that's more important than staying in hospital and having your diet. So you literally stand on that sort of line between, you're incapacitated, but it's in your best interests, or actually, you've almost got capacity because you almost make this decision, so you can do it anyway. And that's a junction that I stand at quite frequently in chronic anorexia.
And Richard, where do you stand on that junction between unwise decision, which may be based on someone's values or belief systems, and a decision that's beyond that and actually is overly influenced by something beyond their control, I suppose?
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's very, very difficult. I think it's a very difficult area. I think one thing that Ty mentioned earlier is very relevant here, which is this thought that this is an illness which presents with a particular set of symptoms and you see it in different patients and so on. And I think if you've got that view and you think of anorexia as very much sort of bringing a package of things, then I think the plausibility that this really is something that's interfering with how they're thinking goes up. Right? I mean, because it's not just this one-off thing, right? I mean, it's part of a package, and that suggests that something's gone wrong in some more systematic way. So I feel the force of what Ty is saying there. Again, it's difficult though, because of course, you know, when we go back to the cases where we think we do need to respect a patient's values. So for instance, in religious cases, you're talking about people refusing treatment on religious grounds, things like that. Again, you might think, well, there's something like a syndrome here, right? Being religious brings with it a whole load of different things. So I suppose one of the things I think that's most striking in the eating disorder case are these, you know, straight out misperceptions that I was talking about earlier with the case of someone saying, well, I fit through the door or something like that. And I do think that when you've got evidence like that, then that really is good evidence that something is really going wrong with the person's mental capacity. And so you can kind of extrapolate from that across to the values and think, okay, well, then maybe the values really have gone wrong.
Okay, so let's think now about dependency on drugs or alcohol and the influence that might have on a person's ability to make decisions. Ty, perhaps you can explain what a dependency might be.
If you go by the description of a dependent syndrome, which is very clearly described by a pair called Gross and Edwards, I don't know the name, I think it was in the 70s, and it's got five very clear characteristics. A dependent syndrome always has it. And one of them is primacy of drink or drug-seeking behavior. So it takes over all other aspects of your life in a way that would then make you make decisions that you weren't previously making, you know, which would seem to meet the criteria for a disturbance in the mind or brain, which changes one's ability to weigh matters in the balance.
So on that basis then, can you say, are we wrong to wait for, say, a heroin addict or an alcoholic to be so under the influence of their drug or alcohol that it can be proven that they're that capacity? And actually, you don't need to wait that long, because the fact that they've got an addictive behavior is enough to say they lack capacity.
Yeah, there's some of it that is, but of course, that's so close to an unwise decision that it's almost impossible to disentangle. And, you know, I think you could read it in the law, you could very closely, you could argue it fairly well that they lack capacity, but it would, in terms of healthcare provision, it's just not it's a Rubicon we can't cross, really, because that would produce such a lot of people that needed care rather than sobering up in the cells overnight, which is what we do to them currently. You know, so you would get someone dependent on alcohol who has a very classical withdrawal, say, all around. They're very classical. It's as classical as pneumonia. It's very, very recognizable dependence syndrome. But if they were all deemed to lack capacity and need, you know, can you imagine the number of alcohol dependent, substance dependent people in the world that would need healthcare provision?
Yeah, and you'd presumably have social workers outside pubs.
Yeah.
With a court of protection declaration saying it's lawful to stop this person going into the pub.
Yeah, you'd have to. It would be unworkable.
Yeah. So the Mental Capacity Act is looking at controls or influences that a person might be under in coming to a decision. These are generally internal, causing a disturbance in the mind or brain, but I suppose they might be an external force, perhaps through someone else's undue influence. But if we take away the undue influence point and focus on other external forces such as influences, temptations, etc., what then is the difference between an internal force that might impact on someone's decision making and an external force?
Yes, I do think it's difficult. I mean, obviously with the internal forces, if someone's got paranoid schizophrenia, something like that, then you think something's going wrong within them and they're not understanding what's happening and processing has all gone wrong. And as a result, they're lacking capacity. Whereas in the sorts of cases we're thinking about, certainly with something like an eating disorder, maybe some distortions like that. So ones we were talking about earlier with things like misperception of body size, failure to know quite what will happen if you stop eating or eat at such a restricted calorie intake. But a lot of it feels like is going to be more to do with just having internalized some values about how important it is to keep your weight down, values around body image and so on and so forth. So that's very much coming from outside. So what are the conditions under which you think that sort of external influence has actually undermined your capacity, rather than just thinking it's a capacity that's exercised on the basis of, you know, those surprising external influences? And yes, I think it is useful here to compare it to something like religion. So if you're in a very closed religion that has what people outside the religion might think of as very strange views, you might pick up on a lot of those views. But it's not obvious that under those circumstances, we would think your capacity was being compromised. And you just think, oh, that's someone who believes those sorts of things. And we've got to respect that. And with medical treatment, typically, we do respect that. I mean, we're cautious if you're making those decisions for your children, say. But if you're making them for yourself, we do tend to respect them. So, you know, what might it be that's different about eating disorders? And I think one interesting thing that Ty was mentioning earlier was around this idea that eating disorders can be characterized as a syndrome which have other symptoms. And you might think that the presence of those other symptoms actually does indicate that something has really gone wrong here and that the person is unable somehow to process the information properly, and that's what's giving rise to the values that they have. But, you know, it's a tricky argument to make, I think. And I think, you know, I'd like to know a lot more about why we should think that's so different from the person who's in a religious group. You know, or maybe we should go the other way. Maybe we should think, well, actually, the religious group, that's equally problematic, and we should think there's a lack of capacity there. But if we were to do that, it would be a radical change on the way we ordinarily think about it. And once you go from religious groups, you know, you are a believer in some kind of strange social media conspiracy theory. We don't normally think that indicates a lack of capacity.
And from your perspective, we're talking about control and voluntary or involuntary decision making. In those circumstances, do you think someone is making a decision because of a disturbance in their mind, rendering them incapable of using or weighing that information?
Yeah. So I would be very reluctant to think that even in the case of addiction, of alcohol addiction or to other drugs, that I'd really want to think that was involuntary. I mean, it still seems to me it's voluntary behavior. William James has a famous piece in The Principles of Psychology where he says, you know, if there were cannonballs shooting across the room, someone would still cross the room to get their glass of gin. this turns out to be false. You know, people don't do that. If they're a cannonball shooting course, they wait or they go somewhere else. People are on, you know, long distance flights, stop smoking. It's not that they're just forced to smoke. So I think it's always voluntary. I mean, the issue is that in a case of addiction, I think there are forces on you which are acting very, very powerfully. So, you know, you have cravings, you have other features like this, which are pushing you towards a certain kind of behavior. And it's very hard work to resist it. So you're working very hard to stop that. So I think, you know, even if you don't think the behavior is involuntary, you might think that there is a sort of understanding or excuse that's provided by the degree of self-control that would be required to overcome what's going on there. So people can resist for a while, but, you know, it gets harder and harder. And there's no obvious upper bound to just how hard it might become. With eating disorders, I'm not sure whether things are quite the same, but I suspect there's something not unlike that. I mean, you can hold these desires and values in check to some degree, but if you've really got them, you're going to be moved by them. And in the addiction case, you know, we don't normally think that's a lack of capacity. We do think it's lack of capacity if you've just consumed a lot of alcohol and you're drunk and so you don't know what you're doing. But we don't think that the person who is a habitual drinker, they have high tolerance for alcohol. They don't get terribly drunk. They're just keeping drinking and they're wrecking their health from it. We don't normally think that shows the kind of lack of capacity which entitles us to intervene and actually force them to stop drinking. I mean, we think it would be a good idea if they did. And I think the only times we really would think we were prepared to go against their judgment is either if they're vacillating in their judgment. So some days they say they don't want to drink, and other days they say they do. And you might think there's a sort of real self there and a more superficial self. Or else if they push that drinking to the point where we really see a sort of comprehensive collapse in their mental abilities. And, you know, then that's an interesting question, I think, whether there is something parallel in the eating disorder case, whether you really do think that you've got that sort of general collapse in the abilities such that you think, yeah, this person really doesn't know what they're doing anymore.
Yeah, and I suppose it's probably stretching the comparison too much, but with eating disorder cases, as I said earlier, it's often said that this is the anorexia talking and it's not me. And I wonder with people who are chronic alcoholics, they might also say, this is the alcohol talking, it's not me.
You know, it's interesting. When you look at the, I mean, there's lots and lots of first person stories, right? There's tons and tons of stuff here. And I think you just get a divide. You get some people who very much say, it isn't me, it's this thing that's kind of got inside me. And I think under those circumstances, there are grounds for thinking, you know, okay, so to preserve your autonomy, we need to help you from this. You've been captured in this way, and we need to help you from capturing. And there are other people who say, you know, no, don't patronize me. I'm an addict. That's what I am. You know, maybe it would have been better if I weren't, but I am, and that's where I'm going from now. You know, from what I know of the literature on anorexia, I was at a talk not very long ago by a very interesting anthropologist who'd been embedded in one of these clinics in the US for some years where they sort of personify anorexia as like the Big Al or something like that, that is, you know, taking them over. And her findings from the clinic was that this was a very popular narrative with parents, right? They loved the idea that their daughter had been just captured, daughter or son had been captured by this, and therefore, you know, we could just fight, you know, we just fight. But many of the patients themselves were much more ambivalent, and they felt, you know, in some sense, they'd been sort of marginalized by this story that said they'd just been taken over. And they were, you know, there were some very interesting conversations where they were talking about what a struggle it is to resist the food, and they thought this was a great achievement. So, you know, they felt they were actually exercising their choice, their capacities in achieving this goal. So, you know, you're really left with the thought that what's gone wrong here is the values they've got, rather than somehow the sort of executive powers they have to live according to those values.
And perhaps this goes to that notion of the authentic self, i.e. who am I? In the context of alcoholism or addictive behaviors, there might be a choice or a perceived choice to drink more, but when is that choice a free choice driven by the individual's personality and driven by another force disturbing their mind and effectively taking over or controlling them.
Exactly. And as I was saying before, I don't think it's just to do with length of time. I mean, I think you could have been doing something for many years and still feel it's not really you, that in some sense it's forced upon you. But I think it is to do with, you know, some idea of how much the person identifies in that way. Now, you know, again, you might think that's false consciousness. You might think, you know, well, deep down, they're not really like that. They're just saying that. But I do think we're in, we're in deep waters once we start saying, well, actually, deep down, the person isn't really like that. You know, well, who's saying that? That's a very, very strong thing to say. And you really need very good ground. I obviously, Ty has much, much more experience of this than I do. I'm very much speaking as an amateur, but I do find that's the, yeah, that's a strong thing to say.
Yeah, but it's a very paternalism in one sense, and against this pursuit of individual freedom on the other hand, and the court tries to marry the two. And yeah, and it can be quite patronizing to assume someone else is assuming what is in your best interests. But that's what we do. That's what we try to do. And the courts are desperately trying to do.
Yeah. And I don't think it is necessarily patronizing to do something for someone's best interest, even if they're against it. I mean, you know, compulsory pension plans, things like that. Those are all designed as, you know, in the best long-term interest of the individual, even though the individual is probably minded not to save that money in their younger days because they really can't imagine ever getting old and so on and so forth. So, and you know, those sorts of things I think are fine. So I'm not in general thinking that we should never intervene for someone's best interest. I just think we should be clear when we are describing what's going on, whether we're really doing it because we're just coming in and thinking we should intervene in their interest, or whether we're doing it because we think in some sense their autonomy or their control has been compromised. And so this is a sort of liberating thing. We're actually liberating them back to their genuine self. And, I think some mental health things are very much in that camp, and I think others are more difficult.
Yeah, and there are certainly, in my experience, quite a few cases where the courts have intervened because the courts have felt that the person lacks capacity, and either they've made a decision, court's judge measures a decision that it's in a person's best interests to have an NG feed or some other treatment that they expressed a wish not to have, and then afterwards that person has been grateful to the courts for having made that decision and taken over the decision making because they weren't in control of their own thoughts.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, evidence like that is good evidence that was the right call, that there really was a sense in which you were, you know, liberating them. You were increasing their autonomy by intervening there. Even those cases, though, are difficult, I think, because, you know, we do have this tendency that what people say at the end of a process is the real reflection on what they really think. But, you know, of course, there can be plenty of processes which you think are themselves corrupting. So the thing that people say at the end is not necessarily indicative of anything other than the process that's happened.
It's almost confirmation bias, isn't it? You listen to them.
So I was watching this movie the other week, Kidnapped, it's called. It's about a Jewish boy who is kidnapped, literally kidnapped by the Catholic Church in 19th century Italy because he had had an emergency baptism done by the maid. So he now counted as Catholic. And so they kidnapped him from his parents, literally took him away, brought him up in Rome, and he became a Catholic priest. And he said at the end of this, so that was a wonderful thing they did. They did just the right thing. They saved my soul by taking me away from my Jewish parents and bringing me up properly as a Catholic. Yeah. So that's what he says at the end of life. It's not as though you then think, okay, well, then that proves they did the right thing. You think, no, well, that shows the kind of upbringing he had in the Vatican. It's not really terribly surprising that he came to views like that at the end of it. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this is so for in the courts where you get a judgment of compulsory feeding and then afterwards the patient is grateful to that. That seems to me much more plausible. But I am just raising a question mark in general about whether we can always think that a judgment at the end of the process should be the definitive judgment rather than just reflecting where the person has ended up as a result of what's going on. We're deeply social creatures. We don't, you know, autonomously come up with these independently of the social influences on it. So if you change that social situation, you're going to get a different person out of it. Very often, not all the time, but very often you'll get a radical change in the person who comes out of it, and their value system will be different as a result.
Right. Well, thank you, Richard and Ty, for fascinating discussion about mental capacity. We've gone, I think, beyond the Mental Capacity Act, which was intended. Mental Capacity Act, as we discussed, and Ty has very eloquently set out, really looks at disturbances of the mind or brain and is really focused on the internal forces, influences, controls that might be on a person. But I found it fascinating just thinking about the potential external forces, but also from an internal perspective, looking at values, wishes, beliefs, and how they might be influenced by factors sometimes within and sometimes without a person's control. Do feedback to us any thoughts you might have on this discussion. Please do subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, or any of the podcast platforms you use. And please do listen in next time.